This is Richie Unterberger, author of the book The Unreleased Beatles, Music and Film.
This was clearly a prolific time in terms of sheer number of songs laid down by the Beatles in a short period of time, in whole or in part. How would you describe, what is found on the bootlegs in general? I mean, you wrote about this in a few paragraphs in your book, but how would you characterize, what this sounds like, what this is about?
Do you mean specifically the bootlegs from the year 1969?
Yeah, we're totally focusing on 69.
Yeah.
Yeah. The name of the program is going to be The Last Year in the Life of the Beatles, and it'll sort of track their activity chronologically that year.
Okay. The Beatles made a massive amount of unreleased music in 1969. I should say, rather, the Beatles recorded a massive amount of unreleased music in 1969, especially in the first month of the year, January. And the reason for this is because they were doing a very ambitious project. The world knows it as a Let It Be film and album now, but then it was really titled more often the Get Back album and film. And the idea had been to, at the same time, record an album, do their first live concert in 2.5 years, and make a movie, which would be a documentary of the making of this album, concluding with this concert. It was probably too much to bite off at one time, but as a consequence of that, the Beatles were filmed more or less almost every day that month, about 20 of the days of January. And while they were filmed, everything that they were rehearsing or trying to record or just jamming on was caught on tape. Now, not all of it was caught on studio quality tape, but a lot of it was caught on pretty high fidelity tape that was part of the film equipment that was accumulating footage for this project. And it sounds really exciting to maybe a more novice collector, but those of us who've weeded through the hundreds of bootlegs, literally, of material from these sessions know that it's quite patchy, because you have moments of brilliance where they're working on absolutely classic songs like Get Back and Let It Be and Don't Let Me Down. But at the same time, there are just so many really half-baked jams and rehearsals and all these oldies covers, which you think would sound wonderful, of songs by their influences, Carl Perkins, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly. They often have trouble remembering the songs even, let alone playing them well. And even when they're seriously working on new material, often they're kind of grinding it down into the ground because they're trying so hard to get it right. Now, a lot of bands would sound like this, I should add, if they've been bootlegged so extensively, if their rehearsals were bootlegged for hours on end. But when you hear the Beatles doing this, it can be kind of a trial with some really great highlights intermittently, because they're going through the same song literally 40 times in a row often, and it's great for the creative process in a way, but it's not so great for the listener.
Let me ask you to expand on that, because you wrote about it some. How much of this is sort of typical rehearsal sloppiness, and how much of it is indicative of a band kind of losing its way, as historians would learn later?
The unreleased material from January 1969 by the Beatles, it's kind of a mixture, I would say, of the normal rehearsal grind, which is part of any working band's life, especially a very visible and successful one. But it's also mixed in with quite a bit of audio evidence, both in the music and in the chatter in between the takes and during the takes, where, especially with hindsight, we kind of feel like we are listening to the Beatles disintegrate in a way. And that works on several levels. You can hear that on George Harrison's songs, the Beatles, and especially John Lennon, more than Paul McCartney, even though there's that famous scene of a fight between George and Paul in the movie Let It Be, that they're not taking those compositions quite as seriously as the Lennon-McCartney ones. And George had so many songs at this point that he was waiting to record that could not help but foster resentment. And it wasn't that well known at the time, but he even quit the band for about 5 days because he just had enough of that happening to his songs. But on several levels, he was dissatisfied with how things were going with the group.
Let's zoom in on that for a minute. What are we hearing from George in January that's important to underline?
George was both writing more songs in early 1969 than he had ever written before, and also I think he was starting to write better songs than he'd ever written before. And this is coming from someone who likes George's songs from the start. But they were reaching, I think, a new level of melodic sophistication, and also they were increasingly reflecting his spirituality, his religious concerns. So during the January 1969 sessions by the Beatles, you hear him present some songs which would make it onto the All Things Must Pass album in 1970. All Things Must Pass itself, they tried to get a take of that for days on end, it seems, when you're listening to the sessions. Hear Me, Lord, and Isn't It a Pity. Those are other examples of standout songs that he had already written that were surfacing during those sessions. And even though it would end up being a hit single and a highlight of Abbey Road, they were starting to work on something during those sessions. And that's a really funny moment when he gets to a line that he hasn't finished yet, and he's singing Something Attracts Me Like a Cauliflower, because he hasn't thought of the line yet, and he actually asked John and Paul for help, and they do try to help him. But there was too much George Harrison material to fit on what had been the standard structure for Beatles album up to that point, where they gave him basically one song per LP side. So the typical album from 1965 onward would have two George Harrison songs, because the White Album was a double album. It had four George Harrison songs. Well, now George Harrison had more than four good songs. And John and Paul probably weren't prepared to give him that room, let alone kind of split up the material in roughly three equal portions.
Well, when Let It Be comes out, there's two pretty slight George Harrison contributions. So it sort of belies what was beginning to happen with his creative output at the time, at least from what you've been telling us.
I would agree that the two George Harrison songs on Let It Be, they're not among his better ones, and certainly not among the better ones that he was even kind of debuting for the band at the sessions, like Something, but also All Things Must Pass, and some of the other material that surfaced on the All Things Must Pass LP. But having said that, I think that ultimately it wasn't such a bad thing that those songs weren't used from the All Things Must Pass album in Beatles versions, because I just don't think, especially when you hear them go through literally dozens of passes at All Things Must Pass, that the Beatles could have handled it as well as George did on his own. For some reason, they just didn't seem to be able to get to grips with that kind of song. Maybe it was because the very personal nature of George's spirituality coming out in a song like that, they just found hard to reflect as a group effort, as a team effort. Just like later on, I think it would have been very hard for the Beatles to do most of the songs on John Lennon's Plastic Ono album, because they were so personal in a different way.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You're doing great, Richie. I'm so grateful for your input and your time here.
Thanks.
What was going on elsewhere in music that might have driven the notion that the Beatles should return to the live stage and even take on this endeavor to begin with?
At the beginning of 1969, I would say there had been a trend in rock music for about a year or so that was kind of back to the basics. Psychedelia and some of the excesses that go with that had kind of peaked in 1967, and the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, although not a particularly excessive psychedelic recording, had been a big part of spurring a lot of groups to experiment pretty wildly in the studio, especially, and sometimes live. But in 1968, there were numerous albums coming out that were reflective of a desire to get more back to rock and roll basics and more straightforward and earthy songwriting and playing. Bob Dylan's John Wesley Harding is the album most cited as kind of kicking off this trend, but I would also add the Byrds' country rock album, Sweetheart of the Rodeo, and the band's first record, which was a big influence on George Harrison. He even does a couple of band numbers at the January 1969 sessions. And the White Album itself, even though it was hardly devoid of studio experimentation, that was much more grounded in straightforward rock than the Beatles' 1967 recordings had been, sometimes very much so. And I think that as part of that, Paul McCartney especially felt, wouldn't it be great to get back in front of a live audience? Maybe it's working on a subconscious level. He and the other Beatles might have also been thinking, we're kind of going in that direction anyway of gutsy songs like Get Back, say, or I've Got a Feeling that we could play live pretty easily. And they do play them live at the end of the Let It Be film. Wouldn't that be a good opportunity to go back in front of a live audience and have fun, at least, you know, in a limited way? The idea had been maybe to do one or two concerts for the documentary, but it didn't work out that way for various reasons. The chief among them being that the Beatles were fighting so much among themselves, they couldn't even agree on how to present the concert or where to do it. So it was a good idea, and the idea of doing an album without overdubs, doing it live, both in concert and in the studio, which was also part of the original idea. As George Martin has said, that was a very clever one, and it could have worked very well, except that the Beatles weren't getting along as well as they had. And also, I would say that John Lennon's songwriting was not in peak form. He didn't have a lot of really quality new compositions presenting to the group. Don't Let Me Down is a great exception, of course, but it was really Paul who was carrying the ball in that regard more than John. And George, as I said, he was coming up with some really good material, but A, the Beatles, John and Paul, weren't sure they wanted to give him that much room, and B, some of it wasn't all that suited for the Beatles group treatment.
Let me interject here. And I don't want to be making stuff up, but if any of this sounds genuine, it strikes me as that, and I wonder about the influence of performers in bands like Jimi Hendrix, who was spending a lot of time in England, and Cream, maybe, who I think in 68 might have been having some of their big performances.
Yeah, certainly.
The Who. You know, there are bands that are, as live acts, are, you know, from Monterey, you know, not quite to Woodstock, you know, beginning to, you know, really show their chops live. And I'm just wondering, you know, if there's any way to authenticate whether or not some of these influences might have been nudging the Beatles back toward the stage, at least in McCartney's mind, saying, you know, we got to step up.
As for the possibility that the success of some of the heavier rock acts like Cream and Jimi Hendrix and The Who in the late 60s might have been a factor in getting the Beatles to think about going back on stage, it's possible. I must say that I've never come across a specific reference where Paul McCartney, the one who wanted to play live the most, certainly, or any of the other Beatles might have been thinking, well, Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton with Cream, they're taking live performance to a new level, and we're the best group in the world. We have to show that we can compete on that level too, besides making the greatest studio records in the world. I don't recall any comments of the time being made then or since, but it's certainly a possibility, because certainly the Beatles were big fans of Jimi Hendrix. They would have been very aware of the effect he was having on concert audiences, having seen him do concerts themselves sometimes. And George Harrison, of course, was becoming a very close friend of Eric Clapton. I do think that the friendship between George Harrison and Eric Clapton, and George had said this, was in part responsible for getting George to focus much more on his guitar as his main instrument than had been the case in, say, 66 and certainly 1967, when he was studying Indian music very seriously, sometimes with Ravi Shankar. I think that was a big influence in getting George to get much more re-immersed in electric rock guitar. And you can hear that on the White Album to some extent, and you can also hear that on all of their 1969 recordings virtually, not just the ones they made in January 1969 during the Let It Be sessions, but also the Abbey Road sessions. George really asserts himself very strongly on guitar, and in some cases starts to incorporate some of the swooping, sliding effects that would become kind of a trademark of his early solo work as well.
Mm-hmm. The sort of standard story on the Beatles has evolved to suggest that January was mostly the Let It Be output and Get Back, which resulted in the last album heard by fans, and that those releases were somewhat subpar, and that the Beatles then gathered back together for one last great push. But you point out that the beginnings of Abbey Road also are very evident in this month. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Sometimes historians paint a picture of this period, of the Beatles in 1969, as the Get Back, Let It Be sessions from January 1969 being kind of unsuccessful and an album eventually being pasted together from that. That was not up to the usual standards of Beatles product. And then Abbey Road being kind of the group coming back together for one last triumph, knowing even that it was going to be the last time they were recording together. Now, looking back on that, especially when you look at the comments of the time, I don't see a whole lot of evidence that the Beatles consciously thought, oh, this is going to be our last album, let's go out with a flourish. I'm not sure they realize at all that it was definitely going to be the last album. But having said that, it kind of sounds like they've marshaled the resources to do that. But one additional factor which makes me think, well, it wasn't like, oh, they were unhappy with how Let It Be, Get Back came out, so they kind of put it in deep freeze and they kind of went back to the drawing board to do an album that was really more properly executed. It's that much of the material, in fact, the considerable majority of the material that showed up on Abbey Road is played at some point in January 1969 during those filming and recording sessions for the Get Back / Let It Be project. I mean, even some songs which aren't identified with the Let It Be sessions at all come up during those sessions, like She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, for instance, or I Want You, She's So Heavy, Octopus's Garden. It's widely known, relatively speaking, that Maxwell's Silver Hammer was attempted a lot in January 1969, and George and John kind of didn't like having to run through the song so much because they weren't big fans of the song to begin with.
But it was 1969's Ubladi Ublada, evidently.
Yeah, I like the song, actually, but A, it wasn't George and John's favorite kind of Beatles music, and B, Paul is such a perfectionist in the studio that they quickly got tired of running through it over and over and over again, maybe more tired than they did of getting through Get Back over and over again. I think everybody loved the Get Back song. Ringo really loved the Get Back song. He mentioned that in the anthology book. But there's all sorts of bits and pieces that are cropping up. There are relatively few Abbey Road songs of which there are no evidence of being worked on in some form during January 1969. So Abbey Road, in a sense, is more a matter of let's approach the project of recording a studio album in a much more organized and effective fashion than we did with the Let It Be and Get Back sessions in January 1969.
So I know you have all of this. I think I have what is commonly known as Sweet Apple Tracks or something, maybe a couple hours of this stuff, mostly off the film, unused film soundtrack. But if you were going to direct Beatles fans' ears into this material, knowing that maybe they only had 20 minutes to spend with it, what, if anything, in there is important or a listenable, finished, unreleased track or fragment that, you know, you think is interesting or historically important or fun?
Yeah. There are more or less about 100 hours of unreleased music from January 1969 that the Beatles did. And there is a bunch more from the Abbey Road sessions later in that year. Here are some of the highlights. Like, if you're just trying to listen to tracks that tell you something about the Beatles that you might not be aware of from their official recorded output and are very fun and educational at the same time. In the Let It Be sessions, there is a jam in the final part of the month after Billy Preston enters the picture and starts playing with him every day virtually, where you can hear seeds of I Want You and She's So Heavy starting to emerge. And when you hear the track on Abbey Road, you don't necessarily think of it as a jam, but in a way, that loose aesthetic that produced so much subpar music during January 1969 for the Beatles, here's one instance where it seemed to lead to something productive, because they managed to finally get hold of an interesting riff, an interesting phrase, and you can hear very quickly that John Lennon especially, but all of the Beatles, are making something of it. That early version of Something from the January 1969 sessions is very interesting because it's very tentative and George has a lot of the lyrics and melody together, but he's clearly having trouble with some lyrical phrases, especially the one where he sings something in the way she moves attracts me like a cauliflower or something like that. And some reports have it that the Beatles were getting along terrible and George especially was really upset with Paul. But you can hear him plainly asking for feedback and help in finishing these lyrics. And John and Paul do not ignore him. They really try and help him. So it's an example of how, even though there were a lot of serious tensions at the time, they still had a lot of affection for each other and a lot of professionalism and did pull together, especially when they recognized probably that this could be a really, really good song. They tried to pull together and help him. Also, from the Abbey Road sessions themselves, there's an unreleased, or I should say there's kind of a long version of Something where it's very close to the release version, but at the end, it goes into this instrumental jam, which has nothing to do melodically with the rest of the song. It's led by a piano, and as I've written in my book, The Unreleased Beatles Music and Film, it's so downbeat, it's such a dirge that it sounds like they're unconsciously supplying the soundtrack to their own funeral. It's very odd, and John Lennon would resurrect a hook that he plays on the piano in that song for Remember from the Plastic Ono album, which is an interesting example of how sometimes the Beatles would record something that didn't work out, but there might be an idea in there that they would resurrect a year later or even years later. Did you want more examples? There are more, but I don't know how much material you want to use.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I need to, you know, revisit what I've got. Otherwise, I'd be asking a few more questions, probably specifically about the fragments and stuff. But no, that's good. Do you want to take a crack at looking at or just considering the track list of each one? You know, because I don't want to take really much more than a half an hour, and we're just about there. But to say anything, you know, to pick maybe a couple tracks from Let It Be and a couple tracks or three from Abbey Road to say something about that, you know, or like kind of close to your heart or that you know something special about that you think would be fun to share.
Okay. Let me think about Let It Be for a minute first. And you're definitely talking about songs that made the finished album, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
Well,
and I've got the track list here if it's not impressed into your brain.
Oh, it is, believe me. Well, we can start with Let It Be itself.
Okay.
The song. I think that Let It Be, the title track of the Beatles album, or what became their last album, it's a real highlight of their final year of recording. It was recorded for the most part in 1969, although a little overdubbing was done in early 1970. And Paul McCartney sometimes gets slagged as being a little bit of a superficial songwriter, especially compared to John Lennon, who was also in the band. But I think this is a really fine example of the peaks he could hit as a lyricist, because it almost has a gospel feel, but it's more universal than a lot of gospel songs to my ears, because it's not tied to a specific religion. It has a message of reassurance and hope that strikes a chord with anybody. I mean, you might actually hear it played at religious services of several faiths because it almost has that liturgical feel. But it's very dignified without being sappy, and it emerged from a dream in which he had about his mother, but it, unlike some of his solo work, does not succumb to over-sentimentality. And I think the piano-organ combination in the arrangement for that song in particular is very inventive. maybe I should pick a John Lennon song from that album just for balance. I think that clearly the best John Lennon song from the January 1969 sessions, although I'm sorry, I might be getting ahead of myself. I was going to cite Don't Let Me Down, but it didn't make the Let It Be film, even though it was right in the middle of those sessions. Do you want me to definitely pick something from
Don't
the Let
Me
Be
Down
album?
It was in the film. It didn't make it to the album. It was the flip side of Get Back.
Yeah, I know.
So you definitely, it'll be, yeah, I'm definitely going there. So
okay, I'll pick that one.
Because I actually have somebody talking at length about Across the Universe, for example. So.
Yeah. I think that the best John Lennon song that the Beatles did during their January 1969 sessions was Don't Let Me Down. Even though it wasn't used on the Let It Be album, it is part of the film, and it was used as the flip side of Get Back, which, of course, is a part of the album and film, Let It Be. And I think that's a superb illustration of John Lennon's perhaps underrated capacity as a balladeer, as a writer of love songs. And I think it's also the most effective lyrical illustration or reflection of his relationship with Yoko Ono. Some of the songs that he wrote that were inspired by the relationship, they're a little grating either in their sentimentality, more in the later years, the post-Beatles years, or in maybe their blind devotion. But this has more of a tender quality, I think, than some of those other songs where he's obviously singing about his relationship with Yoko. And it's got a very yearning, aching feel. But at the same time, this is something the Beatles were great at for a lot of their songs. It isn't balanced too much one way or the other in one direction, because there's also kind of just a really superb upbeat flavor, especially to the harmonies in the chorus. And something that fans might not be aware of that comes through from listening to the unreleased versions of this song, especially the very early ones, is that even though it's often reported that John and Paul were writing completely separately at this point, when John Lennon brings the song in at the beginning of January 1969, it's obviously incomplete, and it's quite apparent from the chatter during those early sessions that Paul McCartney helps a great deal in smoothing out some of the ideas, introducing some melodic things into the song, and really helping John finish the song. The partnership was not totally dead at that point.
I think it's interesting when you watch the rooftop concert that John is clearly relying on Paul to sort of even help him get through the performance. You know, it looks like he's looking to him to remember the lyrics and find that harmony groove. Anyway, that's just an aside on my part, but
yeah,
but I agree with you. That's a moment in that rooftop concert where you sort of feel the energy of them as creative brothers again.
Yeah, the rooftop concert. It's very fortunate that was captured for the film, because so much other footage in the movie shows them being a little dispirited, and John Lennon certainly could have used Paul McCartney's help in remembering the lyrics to that song, because or at least one of the versions they did in the rooftop, and you can see it in the film, he does kind of not remember all the lyrics. He always had more of a problem with lyrics than Paul did.
Hey, Richie, can you confirm for me? There's one angle of the rooftop concert where it actually looks like somebody is holding a cue sheet or a lyric sheet below John. Do you remember seeing that, or am I making that up?
Yeah, that certainly occurs. I couldn't vouch for exactly what song it is, but you definitely see that at least one point, maybe more.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's advance to Abbey Road to give you a crack at just a couple of favorites. You know, and I know that's saying a lot to ask you to just pick a couple things in a
that's all right,
an outstanding album. But
I want to say something about a song of George's. So I think that one of the highlights of the Abbey Road album is the song Here Comes the Sun. And it could be George Harrison's best composition as a member of the Beatles. A lot of people would vote for Something, which is also on Abbey Road. And Something is a little too saccharine for my taste, especially in the violins that are used in the arrangement. But Here Comes the Sun, it's almost like a very updated Buddy Holly. It has such a pure, almost like clear water stream feel. He just sounds so at ease and spiritually upbeat in that song. It's kind of like a folk rock song, but it's given a Beatle treatment by the harmonies. I think Paul was a great contributor to that. And also a sense of maybe slight mystic astral uplift by just really faint touches of synthesizer, which were not very common in rock recordings at that time. And if there's anything to regret about Abbey Road being the Beatles' last album, is that you really feel George Harrison finally becoming the equal of John Lennon and Paul McCartney as a songwriter. Not just a good songwriter, but, you know, there's no way he can be as good as John and Paul, which is the case for the other Beatles albums. He's approached the same level with Here Comes the Sun and Something. And theoretically, it would have been interesting if the Beatles could have done at least one or two more albums and had been doing as many George Harrison songs as Lennon McCartney songs, how that would have worked out. Of course, we know that didn't come to be. Now, let me think of the other song I want to mention in there. Well, probably no one else is going to pick Oh Darling, so can I pick that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. One of the songs on Abbey Road that I wouldn't say is one of the more lyrically sophisticated, but that I always liked a lot, was Oh Darling, because it has such a great Paul McCartney rock vocal on that. And John Lennon, in one of his final interviews, he was never overabundant in his praise for the Beatles' work, especially for Paul's, because maybe there was just so much rivalry there. But he did say that was a great one of Paul's, and he said, I wish I could have sung that. Now, I think it was the appropriate decision to let Paul, who was really the songwriter of the tune, do the track. And it has kind of a doo-wop feel, but at the same time, kind of almost a Cajun feel. And this isn't too widely known, but the track was so popular in Cajun country in the United States after Abbey Road was released that some stations down there played that track like it was a single. It just resonated so deeply with the kind of swampy, earthy feel of Cajun music in that region.
Well, it was sort of like an update on Fats Domino, but just like, totally one foot in 1969 rock scene, but the other foot in 1957 or 59.
I would agree that Oh Darling sounds kind of like a combination of a genuine vintage late 50s track, maybe by somebody like Fats Domino, but also not done in a retro way, done in a way that's very much 1969 rock guitar arrangement. The Beatles were always good at that. When they look back to an obvious influence, they didn't just imitate it or make it sound like, oh, we're trying to update it, but it's really way inferior to the original. They made it sound like them, and they made it sound modern. And another outstanding example, when you talk about the Beatles and Fats Domino, of course, is Lady Madonna, a hit 1968 single, where it was obvious that Fats Domino was an inspiration for that. But Fats Domino probably couldn't have come up with those cryptic lyrics or the inventiveness of the multi-harmony arrangement in the vocal department.
Okay, anything else that, you know, as you were heading your way over there, you felt like, God, I just have to say about this time of the Beatles? There's so much you could say, obviously,
yeah.
But I just in interest of time. And
the only thing I wanted to say is that as erratic as the January 1969 unreleased recordings by the Beatles are, it does make you regret that they couldn't hang together for at least another album or two, because even at such a low point, or one of the lower points in their creativity, they were still coming up with so many songs, so constantly, that you think, well, there had to be room for some more material to emerge from these guys. But also, in hindsight, it just was not meant to be. There were too many tensions at work, both musically and personally, and unfortunately from the business end, especially when Alan Klein took over the affairs of three of the four Beatles. Looking back, it's hard to imagine it could have lasted any longer than it did.
Yeah. Well, Richie, thank you so much.
Okay, sure.